is just the kind of commentary on this subject that I would have hoped for from on a platform of an organization like the Philadelphia Society. I hope that if a tape recorder was not in operation, that you can do something with that outline so that we might reflect on those words at our leisure. Our next speaker, appropriately enough, is engaged in doing precisely, as a citizen, what Frank just suggested, monitoring the news media. He is a graduate of the University of Utah, 1942. Spent a little time in the Marine Corps, 1942 to 1946, and was involved in the Japanese occupation, 1946-1948. Fulbright Scholar, Oxford, 1949 and 1950. And he has been an economist with the Federal Reserve Board from 1951 to the present time. He still is. In 1969, he did what he anticipated Frank's suggestion and founded an organization called Accuracy in Media. And let me read to you several quotes from people who have an appreciation for his organization. "I believe you must be the most thorough reader that the New York Times has," unquote, Arthur Ox Sulzberger. "This is a singular, scholarly, and valuable effort undertaken by private citizens to seek accurate, objective, non-biased news reporting and commentary," unquote, by Congressman Philip Crane. And finally, this from Barron's: "Accuracy in Media is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization launched a few years ago by a group of concerned citizens who had become increasingly fearful that the content and presentation of the news by many sectors of the media were undermining the democratic processes and threatening our freedom. AIM has not blinked at taking on some of the leading lights of the liberal establishment. Perhaps its chief claim to fame has been its confrontations with the Columbia Broadcasting System." It is now my pleasure to introduce the chairman and founder of AIM, Mr. Reed J. Irvine.
Thank you, Court. As the last speaker on this very excellent program, I want to take this opportunity to thank the Philadelphia Society for arranging such a stimulating gathering. It's the first time I've had the pleasure of attending one of these sessions, and I've enjoyed it immensely, perhaps because I'm a bit of a masochist. I suppose that most conservatives seem to be a bit masochistic as they gather together and they enjoy flailing themselves and weeping and as they contemplate the world around them. It reminds me a little of the story of a college professor who served long, and in his most of the students remembered him as a man in his late 60s or 70s, and one of his students, when he passed on, went to heaven, he found his old professor there. And the professor was sitting on the cloud in the company of a lovely young lady. And the student was a little surprised to see this, but he said, this may have been Professor Vandenhag, I don't know. But he said, Professor Jones, it's great to see you here, and I'm glad to see that you are finally getting your just rewards. And the professor said, "Reward hell, I'm her punishment." So, I think it's, I'm kind of an action-oriented person, and I think it's appropriate that after we've contemplated how bad things are, that we talk a little bit about how we can make them a little better. There's been a lot of talk lately, I think especially since the downfall of Nixon and others, of the mix of the media becoming the fourth branch of government. Certainly we're more aware than ever before of the power of the media, although this awareness goes back a good many years. But it has been intensified in recent years. I'm reminded a little bit of another incident that Herman Kahn told me several years ago. Early in the Nixon administration, he went to visit the Undersecretary of Defense, David Packard. And Mr. Packard, as I'm sure you all know, is a very wealthy man. And Herman was asking him why he didn't do this and didn't do that. And Mr. Packard said, well, Mr. Kahn, you have to understand that if I did these things, I would be criticized by the New York Times. And Herman said, imagine that. Here's a man worth $350 million, and he's afraid to be criticized by the New York Times. But that, unfortunately, is the kind of world we live in. I've often called this the age of pusillanimity, because people are tremendously afraid of being criticized, and certain organs of the media are very quick to criticize because they're very much aware of the power that they have. What is the check? We were talking earlier about the checks and balances in our government. We have a marvelous system which provides, somebody will, we're happy to, excuse me, I just saw somebody come in, I was going to make a comment. We have a system of checks and balances, but if we do have a fourth branch of government, what is the check? What is the balance on this fourth branch? I remember a few years ago, Time magazine ran a full-page ad talking about this, and they said the check is our readers. We often hear from television, I don't know whether Frank Shakespeare ever alluded to this when he was with CBS, but people in television like to say, well, the check is our viewers. They can turn us off or they can switch to another channel. But I submit that this is not a very effective check. The disorganized masses of readers and viewers, as a matter of fact, I think are by and large treated with contempt by the people in the media. I speak as one who has been an inveterate letter writer for many, many years, and one generally finds that letters are either disregarded or treated with as replied to with form replies. I see a lot of this now as people send in their complaints to Accuracy in Media, and they sometimes send the kinds of replies that they get from CBS or NBC, and one can't see that the moguls of the media take these criticisms very seriously, coming from the average viewer or from the average newspaper reader. Well, obviously, government is ruled out. The First Amendment takes care of that. What about advertisers? This is something I'm frequently asked. Can't they exercise more influence? I'm afraid that as far as broadcasting and the major papers are concerned, the answer is no. It may be the advertiser may have a lot of influence in a small town. But in the national scene, the media are more important to the advertisers than the advertisers are to the media. And in any case, our big businessmen impress me for the most part as not being people who are terribly seized of the importance of ideas and the transmission of information that may be undermining the system under which they operate. That is a topic really for an entirely separate talk. But basically, it relates to the fact that our big businessmen, don't understand the power of ideas, and I submit that they are much more inclined to be economic determinists, Marxian economic determinists, if you will. They think that events in the world are influenced by economic events rather than by ideas. Whereas, ironically, the Marxists, as Frank just indicated, are very much aware of the power of ideas and are very adept at using them to influence the course of history. Even when these types control broadcast facilities or newspapers, they typically surrender control of the content to others. All too frequently, I'm afraid, they surrender to the hands of those whose idea of freedom is to give maximum exposure or play to the opponents of freedom while severely censoring those who are the proponents of freedom. I had an experience the other day which confirms this. I had a long conversation with the general counsel of RCA, which owns NBC. In the course of the conversation, I alluded to the fact that recently NBC put on the Today Show, almost back-to-back, Angela Davis and Morton Sobel, a gentleman who was involved in the Rosenberg spy case. Both of them had recently written books. The gentleman I was talking to is not at all concerned about this. And I see nothing wrong, per se, with giving this valuable airtime to Angela Davis, for example, to plug her book. This is a notion that is consistent with our ideas of freedom of information and exchange. But what did concern me was the fact that this vast, capitalistic, powerful enterprise sees nothing wrong with censoring, giving no time to an individual such as Jay Parker, who has written a book about Angela Davis, which is critical of Angela Davis. And so it is Angela who stands on the platform alone, plugging her ideas, which are inimical to the continued existence of RCA as a private corporation, while the author who is working to undermine her efforts is, in effect, absolutely barred from this opportunity to get his ideas across. Well, this comes down to the fact, I think, that the check on the media has to come through some kind of citizen action. And to be effective, it has to be organized. That is, we all must pool our resources and, to the maximum degree possible, work together. We need systematic, professional criticism, and we need a follow-through capability. By professional criticism, I mean something that is not emotional, must not be based on sweeping generalizations. These generalizations may appeal and delight, titillate the critics of the media, but they don't do very much good with the people that we're trying to influence in the media. Even our friends in the media are irritated by generalizations to the effect that they are biased and unfair and so on. Inaccuracy in media was founded with a notion that, I might use a Shakespearean quotation, that thrice is he armed that hath his quarrel just, and he but naked, though locked up in steel, whose conscience with injustice is corrupted. Our idea was that you must be, if there is something wrong with what the fare that you're getting in the media, it must be something wrong factually, must be something wrong with the method of presentation. So we focused on factual inaccuracy and on a failure to report significant information, or on the kind of emphasis that is given, an overemphasis on certain information while virtually neglecting or failing to report certain things, and also on mixing opinion with news. I give you an illustration. Recently, Jack Anderson wrote a column on the International Police Academy. This is an academy located in Washington. It's funded by or part of the Agency for International Development, AID, which has over the years trained public safety officials from developing countries to make them better officials, better policemen, acquaint them with our modern notions of police tactics, methods, and so on. This organization has been a target of the left for a long time, partly because the stability of some of these countries depends. The police are the front line of defense, and they are the people that the left has to overcome in the first place if they're going to achieve their objectives. So the left has made no pretense of its desire to get rid of this operation and the advice given to the police public safety organizations. Well, Jack came out with a column in which he asserted that, or gave the impression that the police academy, if it wasn't actually teaching torture, which is a favorite theme of the left, that at least the trainees who went through this academy frequently came out with strange ideas about torture. And he quoted from some papers. One of the, in the course of study, they have term papers. And the students were, one of the topics that the students were able to, were asked to write on, or had the option of writing on, was the use of force and threats in interrogation. I guess give you an illustration of what Anderson did with this. He said, he quoted Lam Van Hoo of South Vietnam as saying, "What do we mean by force and threat? Physical force, beating, slapping, electrocuting, threats, physical shaking a fist in the face of the subject, verbal, saying, 'Listen, I'm going to break your neck if you don't confess.'" Now this is taken, I went up and looked at these papers that he had quoted from. This was taken from page 7 of this man's paper. "What do we mean by force and threat" is a heading of a section of that paper. And then this heading in his actual paper was followed by a section which Anderson omitted without indicating any omission. The sentence read, quote, "There are two cases which the judge have very often considered as force and threat or torture used in interrogation." And then he went on to describe physical force beating. In other words, he was saying what the judges had said constituted force and threat. Now, Anderson, had he used this, of course, it would have destroyed the value of his quotation. It wouldn't have proved the point that he was trying to make. But that wasn't the worst. He didn't tell his readers about the next section of the paper, in which the writer listed 9 reasons why force and threat should not be used, and he didn't publish his conclusion, which reads, quote, "The use of force and threats is not only a method that is vicious and inhumane, but also dangerous and useless. Those that are for force would do better to quit the police force and take up the career of boxing," close quote. It turned out that he quoted from 6 papers. In 5 of the 6 cases, this was the way it was done, taking the quotations out of context and obviously completely distorting the meaning and intention of these people. Now, what I mean, this has to be an org to combat this. I think there's very little that an individual could do. I don't suppose there are very many individuals in the country who, reading that column, would have any idea of what had been done or would have the capability of doing anything about it. It happens that it was called to our attention. We were able to look at the papers in question, just as Jack Anderson's man had looked at them. We were able to write a 4-page letter to Anderson exposing what he had done and asking for his comment, which he has never replied to, though his man promised to reply. And in the absence of any action on his part to correct this error, we sent out letters to 400 newspapers throughout the country, which print the Anderson column, asking them to print this letter as a correction to the Anderson column, and many of them did. I don't know how many, what percentage, but we have had many clippings back. Now, that is what I mean by the follow-through capability. There's a little additional follow-through capability here. The Washington Post didn't print the letter, and we're kind of dogged. We don't give up too easily. We, after the letter had appeared in other papers, we took a clipping from another paper and we sent it to Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Post, and pointed out that they'd had the letter for 2 or 3 weeks. It hadn't appeared. We said, "Why does the Post deny its readers this information?" And shortly after that, the letter did indeed appear in the Washington Post. So you have to have, again, this is something that the ordinary individual, the citizen, the layman, can't really do on his own. That's why I say you have to pool your efforts. You have to get behind people that have the resources, so that can command the pooled resources to accomplish this type of objective. I'll give you one other illustration. I don't want to go on too long because I'm looking forward to a discussion period. But recently, Charles Bartlett published in his syndicated column a statement. This was commenting on the movement in the OAS to withdraw sanctions against Castro's Cuba. And Bartlett said that, you know, bemoaning the fact that the OAS had not been able to mobilize the 2/3 majority to do this, he said that Castro, quote, "appears to have stopped meddling in guerrilla movements that are at large in many places," close quote. And he went on to claim that Castro had, quote, "advised revolutionaries with whom he had once dealt that he is no longer interested, and he is said to be out of touch with all significant groups," close quote. It just so happened that in the discussion in the OAS on the subject, the Uruguayan ambassador and the Chilean ambassador had both made very strong statements on Castro's activities in support of the guerrillas and subversives in their countries. And these were not going back several years. They were talking about what was going on at this very time. The Uruguayan said that as of May 1974, the Tupamaros, that's the guerrilla group in Uruguay, had three regional units established in Havana, Montevideo, and Buenos Aires. He charged that the office in Havana acted in close cooperation with the Cuban government. He said that statements made by leaders of this movement had revealed that the Uruguayan and Argentinian Tupamaros maintained contact with Havana through the agents of the Cuban government located in Buenos Aires. And he said that hundreds of members of this organization were in Cuba, where they were trained in guerrilla tactics and from whence they derived money in support of arms. The ambassador of Chile, in his statement, quoted a cable from Mexico dated the very day he was speaking, October 23rd, 74, which described a Cuban proposal to Latin American leftists for, quote, a new anti-imperialistic strategy of vast proportions that would be implemented in Chile and then spread to the rest of the hemisphere to its ultimate consequences, close quote. That was by Armando Hart, who is a member of the Central Committee of the Cuban Communist Party. You didn't see that, I expect, in your newspapers. We couldn't find any newspaper that had reported on these statements. By some doggedness, we managed to get these statements from the Department of State. And fortunately, we had them in hand at the time the Bartlett column appeared. And so we sent this letter to approximately 50 papers that carry the Bartlett column throughout the country is to correct the error that he had made about Castro's position. Well, that is the type of thing that Accuracy in Media is designed to do. I think it's the type of thing that has we have done, I think, quite well. We are able to do it because there are people in the country who recognize that this is an important operation, that it's, if you can show the people in the media, people like Anderson, who are have been getting away with murder for years, making statements that people have been too frightened to challenge them on or correct, it's bound in the long run and hopefully in the shorter run to make them more careful. I just want to say one word. There is another important area that we've been active in, and that is in pursuing fairness doctrine complaints. And I know from speaking to some people in this group that there are conservatives or libertarians who have their strong doubts about the fairness doctrine. I've said in part, I think the fairness doctrine is a sham. It's on the books. Senator Pastore thinks that it ought to be enforced. I think that it ought to be enforced. But it is not being enforced. We have won one case out of 13 or 14 that we have submitted. It's a famous landmark case against NBC over their program Pensions, the Broken Promise. But the FCC's decision in that case was overturned by the Court of Appeals in Washington. That decision is now being appealed by AIM. The FCC did not appeal it, although they may still have the option of appealing it to the Supreme Court if we don't get our rehearing in the Court of Appeals. I would only say to those conservatives or libertarians who doubt the desirability of something like the Fairness Doctrine, the Fairness Doctrine has its origins historically in the fears of liberals, the ACLU types and others, who were concerned about the fact that the broadcasters were conservative and were not giving enough voice to, or were dominating the airwaves, they thought, with the conservative views. Now that the liberals have secured substantial dominance of the networks, at least, the ACLU is having second thoughts on this question, and they are moving in the direction of opposition to the Fairness Doctrine. Should the Fairness Doctrine be eliminated, and should, let's say, Texas millionaires of the H.L. Hunt stripe or some other stripe decide to buy control of a network, and should they sack Walter Cronkite and put on, say, George Putnam, and sack Eric Severide and put on Bill Buckley, I would have no hesitation in wagering any sum of money that the hue and cry would go out for a revival of the fairness doctrine. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that the liberals, these people know the value of ideas, they know the importance of ideas, and they're not going to be stopped at using the powerful means of television to get their ideas across. I think it's absolutely stupid if the conservatives say, well, you know, we've got to be fair, and if they dominate the networks and the broadcasting, well, that's the way it is. That's the way the ball bounces. Let them dominate it. I don't think that's the way it bounces. I think that this is a monopoly, essentially a monopoly, and it deserves to be regulated, and we're not asking for domination. The conservatives are not asking for domination. All we want is fairness and the opportunity to present both sides when the networks or broadcaster is discussing an issue of a controversial issue of public importance. And on that note, I better terminate. Thank you.
Thank you very much.